Hey, Water Coolians. Welcome back to another episode of This Year Podcast. In today's episode, we are joined by the incredibly talented Cole Williams. Beyond her remarkable music ability, Cole is a force for positive change in her community and beyond, passionately advocating for social and political causes in the greater New Orleans area. With an iconic voice and unwavering commitment to help creating a better world, Cole brings a sense of authenticity and purpose to her music that truly resonates across the vast spectrum of listeners. An honor to, really a true honor to have her on the show. And by the end of the episode, listener, I think you will also agree and you'll be equally moved by her compassion and insight. But enough of talking about the wonderful person that Cole is. In our first news story today, Cole and I discussed the controversy around the NFL and Apple's decision to alter the official record of Alicia Keys' Super Bowl performance and how changing expectations for creators is shaping alternate versions of history because of the need to be really more than perfect. As Cole says in the episode, "Who has the power controls history." That's a very popular quote we often hear in different iterations, but it emphasizes the vast importance of remaining aware and vigilant on how easily the narrative can be changed, even on one of the biggest stages in the world, as in this case, the Super Bowl. Then we explore the work Cole has done and continues to do so with the Greater New Orleans Citizens Relief Team and how understanding the essence of quote-unquote home can help in how we see one another, and through this continuing to build and foster community and using resources to help the many, not the few. And in the final news story, the conversation explores the impact of music on those with dementia and the influential nature of music in unlocking something deeper, you know, really within us, even to a point on making me think I can dance, which, you know what, I'm going to take that back. I'm a pretty good dancer. But overall, a really wonderful episode that I'm excited to share with you, and an episode that has really made me reevaluate what the show is and what the next level for the show will become. More on that as we get closer and come upon the landmark that is 100 episodes. We still have a few more to go until then. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, this is episode 96 of Water Cooler Talk Podcast titled Language of Music with
Cole Williams.
Enjoy.
This is the story of a podcast that takes weird news from across the world. And while many of these stories may seem fake, they're absolutely not, because they're real.
As someone who has more than a plethora, like even just looking through your catalog of what you've done, I'm like, oh shit, yeah, this is cool. What have been some of those pivotal moments that really captured the essence of why you're on this journey?
I'm just going to go stream of consciousness. The first thing that came to my mind was the first time I sang live backgrounds with Lisa and the Cult Jam at Madison Square Garden. Just to like see the band on stage on those big screens and then to see like the massive amount of people just there for the music. Like it wasn't even current at the time. Music really does touch people in a way that I've never seen music touch people. I mean, anything else touch people before. So that was a moment where I was like, wow, this is something big. I can go somewhere with this. And I would say being able to travel, like I lived in Sweden for a time. I used to sing with an Elvis Presley impersonator in Sweden. In the winters, I'd be in Malmo, Sweden, at this venue called Slapduset, and we would perform these sold-out shows. So it was like Elvis Presley and the Sweet Temptations. We had these custom gowns and wigs, and it was like, wow. Like, they don't speak English. I don't speak Swedish. It was an international band, people from, like, Norway, and we connected with the music. And then I'd say the most profound moment in music would be like what's happening with me now. You just have these flashes of like your life and experiences, the good, the bad, the ugly, the exciting, like all of it. And it's like, you're not upset. You're just like, wow, this is why this happened. And it brought me to working with the houseless at the beginning of the pandemic, using my platform. And I'm thinking, you know, I'm not like a big star like Rihanna. Like, what platform do I have? But it taught me to value my platform. People pay to see me perform. I've been performing my original music for like 10, 15 years. That's like a big deal, but it's not a big deal, but it is a big deal, you know, in this business. So having this platform and being able to say, let me use this like little gift that I have, these resources that I have, and share them with the houseless to bring awareness and work with them. Not like, this is an idea and here, like, this is what you should do, but having conversations like, so who are you? You know, do you want to talk? Yeah, we want to talk. And them sharing why they're living on the street and like what they think they need to get off the street. And being able to put these experiences and the feeling into my music now, it's been the most overwhelmingly satisfying feeling I have, because for the first time, I'm not running this rat race in music. I didn't realize I was running this rat race, but I think we're all running a rat race. And in the music business, it's a specific type of rat race. I was blessed. I was put here to make music. And I have to eat.
Exactly.
I want to help people along the way. Like, I want to share my experiences. And it's not about changing the world, but it's about the process. The journey is like what changes us all. So being able to like have my purpose and my music overlap and intertwine is the most gratifying and humbling feeling.
I know you've talked about, you know, this personal responsibility you do have as an artist. And obviously, throughout this entire conversation that we'll have today, I think we'll really reflect back on that. But this connection of music and how it can connect to communities, vulnerable communities, it can connect through language. I mean, just the feeling of, you might not know the lyrics. Like, I've been listening to a lot of Spanish music as I learn Spanish, and I don't understand everything that's being said, but I understand the feelings, the emotions, the reason for why this is being created, because music is something that really touches into something that is a bit deeper than really any other artistic endeavor that I've experienced, at least in my life. I won't speak for other people because I know some people connect to different, you know, things, but it's so cool to kind of hear your experiences on that other side, because when I was working in music, it was more just like, you know, management and stuff like that. But to hear your stories is such a cool appreciation of a craft that, I mean, you continue to work on each day.
Every day. It's music is life. As a music manager, you're working on another end that is very vital, because as the artist, all we want to do is create the art. You know, we have to learn like the business of music. And so having a collective group that you're working with, that you trust, I mean, it's the same microcosm that I'm using to work with the houseless. It works in every area of life. If you share, you know, we have to stop hoarding all these resources when we make it. You know, how many of us bring back that education, like what we've learned, back to people that can use it, so that everybody isn't starting from zero. So it's like having this mentality of, if I do better, or if we do better, then I do better. You having something doesn't take away from me having anything. Actually, it makes it much better. Like, I think about, you know, think about a neighborhood, right? Maybe it's dimly lit. You know, it's known for having crime. Neighbors aren't really participating in the upkeep. Neither is the city, right? Whoever we place responsible. But imagine that, like, one person says, this is ridiculous. I pay my taxes. I own my home. Like, I'm going to take charge of my neighborhood. And starts talking to all the neighbors. Another neighbor gets involved. And now all of a sudden, they're like, well, they're not changing the street lights, but we can leave our porch lights on. And then we can, like, if we see some activity happening that we don't like, we can, like, actually address them. We can get the police involved, but we can address them on a human level. Hey, we got kids here. What are we doing? And speak to people with the respect and the dignity that they deserve. Even if you think they're doing something wrong, I think it's so important, our reactions. This microcosm of the music business and of working with the houseless, I think if we can use this copy and paste that we always do on our computers, if we can do this this analog copy and paste in humanity, I think that we'll see results. It's not about the end game. It's about the process, the journey, what we're learning.
I love it. Well, Cole, are you ready to jump into the official start of a Water Cooler Talk episode?
Oh, this wasn't it?
I mean, I felt like we could have gone for another 2 hours, but, you know, the people want the strange and interesting news stories, so we got to jump into it. This first news story comes from CBC News Entertainment, written by Natalia Stetchinson, February 14th, 2024. If Alicia Keys' voice cracks at the Super Bowl, but it's edited out, did it even happen? It's a momentary glitch that singers everywhere fear, the dreaded voice crack. So when Alicia Keys belted out the opening notes to her iconic anthem, If I Ain't Got You, during the 2024 Super Bowl halftime show and warbled ever so slightly before recovering. It was a vulnerable, but for many, relatable moment about the realities of live performances. But if you watch the NFL's official YouTube video and Apple Music's official YouTube video of the performance, the crack disappears. Some people want it all, but I don't want nothing at all. Robert Komenki, a music theory and music history lecturer at the University of British Columbia, highlights that while minor edits and tweaks can be common for live performances, we should be concerned with how easy it has become to revise the official record of a live event. Robert states, quote, millions and millions of people can witness something happen, and then the official record will just carry no evidence that it happened, and there will be no acknowledgement that it changed, end quote. Live performances often undergo production tweaks during and after the performance, from adjusting audience noise, censoring swear words, or helping tune in a performer's vocal range. Often, live performances aren't all that live at all. Take the U.S. national anthem, arguably one of the most difficult songs to sing, for example. According to her producer, Whitney Houston's iconic rendition at the 1991 Super Bowl was sung live, but pre-recorded audio was used in the broadcast. Beyonce, at the second inauguration of former President Barack Obama, decided to sing along to a pre-recorded track due to not having the proper time for a sound check. While Key's performance may not have been the first to be altered, it may be the most viewed. The 2024 Super Bowl averaged 123.7 million viewers across television and streaming platforms. Even assuming the best intentions of the NFL and Apple, who currently sponsor the halftime show, Robert states a vocal crack in a performance shouldn't make anyone feel ashamed. He concludes, quote, when I heard that, I was almost a little bit excited, like, oh, these mics really are on. It made me admire her as an artist even more, end quote. So, Cole, to set a bit of a background, because I imagine most listeners of the show have not had a live performance, you know, your career spans various genres and mediums, and you have emphasized the importance of a live performance. Can you share with the listeners what that experience is like and the amount of production that does usually go into a successful live set?
The performance is key. The bells and whistles, those are great. Dancers, those are great, but people are coming to hear the music, right? The song. So like those are the fundamental pieces that need to happen. So it takes practice. Each musician has to know their part. Someone like Alicia Keys, she's probably working with her band for a long time. So they're preparing a special show for the Super Bowl. And then, you know, as a vocalist, I know what I do to prepare for a show. Ideally, you know, if I'm not doing like a 30-day tour or like out on the road for months, I like to have like a day, an afternoon, a morning, just to myself, just to rest my body, because it takes all my energy. Like, I can eat, and I don't really eat steak like that, but I can eat like a whole steak, potatoes, like all that stuff after performing the show, because I've given so much. It's so much energy to sing in key, sing in the moment. A performer like Alicia Keys, you're going to get maybe a slightly different vocal performance, you know, depending on the night and how she's feeling, because she's that type of connected performer versus maybe someone like Beyonce, also like a great performer, but she's a little more well rehearsed. It's a little more choreographed in the vocals and in the dancing. So I think we have to think about like what every performer does. We're putting like performers in this like performer bucket, like we do with everything. Let's generalize performers. And there's like performers that like perform with live instruments, that's their thing. They're pop performers. They're performers that perform to tracks and not live bands. They're performers that aren't great singers, but they're great entertainers. I think to compare, you know, performers on that level of did they crack, things happen. Guitar players, their strings break. Do we talk about that? Oh, their string broke? This is the only instrument, the voice, that we can't replace at Guitar Center. We can't replace this. You know, once it's done, it's done. So there's a lot that goes into this. So a crack, sometimes a crack, that's in the moment. Like they're emoting. Maybe it's poor vocal health. Who knows? But I think for a performer to be trained well vocally and then also trained in experience, a crack is not a big deal.
When I think it goes back to what Robert kind of concluded is like the importance of embracing imperfections. Like we're not these perfect beings. And when you are doing something live, you know, there is that chance that things aren't going to go right. But, you know, you hope that you're here for that moment and you know enough of how to handle that moment. If it does happen, be like, I'm just moving on. Because I think, you know, sometimes you can see when something does go wrong, it can completely destroy a performance. But I mean, Alicia Keys is obviously a multifaceted, talented, you know, singer who, like, she was probably like, oh, that wasn't great, but all right, we're on to the next. And her vocal range is so impressive. And it's just a part of a live performance. And I think, you know, at least for me, the issue becomes, why are we completely erasing that from history? Like, that is a part of that performance, and it made it special. It wasn't just another Alicia Keys performance. I mean, I think, as you said, she brings so much to each of her performances that they are special. But for this moment, this was something I was like, this is real. Back to what Robert was saying, it was real. It happened, and now recorded history. Because it's so strange that the NFL or Apple Music in the video didn't acknowledge that this was a different version. And that's where the concern, I think, comes from, is saying this is what history is going to remember. And obviously, we can talk more about how, you know, you can rewrite history to say whatever you want and kind of the fallacies of doing that and where it's led to today. But when it comes to live performances, I think you do have to embrace the imperfections and realize that we are all human, even if it is somebody like Alicia Keys, Beyonce, Whitney Houston.
This is so deep, Adam, because you're so I have the same question. Why? Like, why erase? We are like seeing history being erased right in front of our eyes. It's something small. You know, we measure it as small, but the fact that it can happen, and it's happened, and it's been happening. Like, who has the power controls history? So why they needed to, you know, do that, I'm not really sure. You know, I also think it speaks to this level that we put entertainers on, that they're different. They're less human. And so, you know, I thought about that too. Like, you know, why do we always find ways to judge? Like, I think we should be happy. Like, wow, she's real. Nobody's perfect. Like, that's a real moment. Because I've cracked on stage and like, what are you going to do? You know, everybody makes a mistake, but it's not the mistake. It's how you bounce back. A vocalist is like an athlete of sorts. So like, she just bounced back. And that was at the, like, the top of the game. So if she was a bad athlete, like, she would have fumbled the rest of her game. But she's such a top-notch athlete that she maintained, took it higher. I'm just solution-oriented, Adam. You know, like, for me, that works. I think we manifest things all the time. And I think that we manifest a lot of negative things that we don't want because of our words. So I'm looking at this Alicia Keys moment like, great, there's somebody else. There's another vocalist out there that, like, had a moment. And it happens.
And it makes somebody like Alicia Keys relatable. Like you said, it's like we're putting these celebrities, these entertainers, these athletes on these pedestals to where they're almost not human. And we're holding them to these standards that are almost impossible to reach. You know, I like to say, especially even in the podcast industry, so many people are looking for this, like, quote unquote, perfectly crafted authenticity. Like, they want you to be real. They want you to be vulnerable, but it has to be good. It's so subjective on what that word good means, even as, I mean, we talked about before recording, this is not a live show. And so if we mess up, yeah, let's get that right. But at what point is that crossing the line? You know, I remember when I first started podcasting, I was like, I need to edit out every single mistake I made. I don't want to put that out to the world because I was not comfortable in that authenticity and that vulnerability at that point in my career. But as, you know, now 7 years into this podcast, almost 100 episodes, most of the time I'm like, I'll just leave it in. You know, I'll probably receive a few emails of people being like, that's not how you pronounce that word. You screwed it up and you insulted all the people of that maybe town or city. But that's a part of the show, is the aspect of, you know, feeling more comfortable with this long form conversation and realizing I'm not perfect. I don't expect my listeners to be perfect. And I don't want to create a perfect product because that's not who I am.
I'm relating to you because when I first started singing in the studio, it had to be perfect. And then the more I started singing, working with different producers, a lot of people will tell you that first take, even if there's imperfections, that's probably the best take. It's the most authentic. I've just gotten in the habit of, when I'm recording, leaving the first take, singing live, like, you know, that's like one of the most interesting experiences because that's really where I just go. You know, I used to be afraid to like take a risk. You know, I had to sing it just like I recorded it, just like I wrote it and composed it. And that's not why people come to hear you sing live. They can stay at home and listen to your record. Like, they want a real experience. So I'm talking and I'm singing, and sometimes I sing like a note and I'm like, that's an interesting note, you know, and then I do something and swerve it back in. And, you know, that's part of the fun of it all. I don't know. There's a time and a place to make things refined and perfect. Like when you're putting a nail in, that needs to be perfect because it's going into like a nail for a house or a, you know, something to me. But as far as being perfect in music, like music is, I was just talking to Lewis, my friend from Rope Dope Records, and we were talking about music, and he said, music is another language. Like, we're trying to like get music into like, why is music so special? But that's because music is the other language.
It creates so much nuance in the way it's performed from the live. I remember watching this documentary, I think, about Billie Eilish, and she was talking about her creation process in the studio and where she went from her and Phineas recording in kind of their house to now, you know, a major record label. And she talked about how for a song, she's recording 20, 30, 40 different times of that same line, and then they're cutting and splicing the best part of each line. If you're looking to watch more about the creation process of Billie Eilish and Phineas, this was part of a Rolling Stones video they did together about the creation process of Bad Guy. And obviously she's at a very different level, to the point of like the audience has put this expectation on her career and her talents to say Billie Eilish is this perfect singer. She never makes mistakes. So as she's, you know, releasing these records and these songs, I won't speak for her, but I'll just speak from my own experiences. When people expect you to be at a different level, there is this added pressure of, I need to make this perfect, because if I don't, now I got people hating me for not being what they expect me to be. And it creates this sense of, I'm disconnecting with my audience if I'm not creating this perfect product for them that they expect from me. And I think that goes into kind of that original question I had posed to you, you know, how audience expectations have shifted, you know, the way music is being presented and consumed. Like, how have you seen that shift throughout your career?
I'm not really sure if it's like so much a shift of the audience or if it's a shift of the way the audience is presented music and the pot, like what's in the pot of music that they have to choose from. Because it's really about the supply and the demand, like what is being supplied to the audience. So I think what's being supplied to the audience always changes based on like what's selling, but based on like the culture, the streets, like what's happening on the ground always dictates. And by the time it gets up to the top, it's something a little more diluted, but you can always see like, so right now, everybody, it feels like everybody just kind of wants to disconnect from what's happening. It feels like it's tough times. Because everybody is just trying to disconnect with music that I appreciate. There's a space for all music, but we need a diverse space for music. So we're getting messages, not really messages to uplift, not really messages to teach, but messages to have fun. But if we're not getting a balanced, you know, group of music, that's also like, what are we teaching? How are we talking about love? Like, how are we educating? What happens to us? So it's like, life imitates art, art imitates life, and we're going back and forth. So back to long-winded, long story longer. Audience expectations. I think the audience always wants the same thing, to feel good, to feel elevated, to feel uplifted. There's not just one way to uplift. You know, we can shake our ass and we can still sing about freedom. We can shake our ass and we can still sing about how we're sharing with our neighbor, how we love each other. You know, there's so many different ways. Like Pharrell, Happy. The song is straight up happy. I mean, that's the most simple, complex, feel good. I mean, those types of songs always transcend because that message always is the same. Like, that's what we want. All we need is love. Reason why there's certain songs that like cross generations and they'll be here like long after we're gone, because those messages always stick. So I think the audience wants that other language that we're not really able to control. They want to feel like that's taking them to a place that they can't really take themselves. Because like me, if I didn't have music, I don't know where I'd be. Music's been my therapy.
To your point of what you're saying, you know, music as this language, it it finds ways to connect and it finds way to share, as we'll get into kind of the second news story. It finds ways to connect communities. And I always view music as this like deeply personal, and sometimes it's not, you know, some songs are just, hey, we just want to dance and have a good time and be happy. But then also music that I like is that music that explores something deeper and does it in a way that's like, oh yeah, I enjoy listening to this just for, you know, the sound of it. But then at the same time, being able to explore the lyrics. And I know obviously a lot of your songs kind of really explore, you know, as you talked about, kind of this houselessness and the conversation around that. But the idea that lyrics can be deeper and there's so many different layers to a song, regardless of what layer you connect on, at least you're somewhat connecting to music and you're finding this experience of like, you and me have very different backgrounds, but through your music, I can be like, all right, I'm starting to understand where she's coming from for a bit.
Yeah. While you're speaking, I'm thinking about how much we really need that gumbo, like that full platter, that diverse plate of music. Because when I'm going out, right, like I'm getting ready to go out, like I'm just hanging out, I have a playlist. And when I'm cleaning my house or I'm just relaxing, I have a playlist. That's a different playlist. And I'm sure like you can relate too. So we seek out certain kinds of music, you know, when we're doing certain things. And whether we know it or not, we're seeking it just to feel comfortable in this space, but also like to move us to the next space. So the audience wants that diverse array of music. And I think that they want it to be polished. And, you know, some things in your house are shiny, some things are dusty. You know, we have all that music that we like. So I'm with Alicia Keys. You know, she shouldn't comment, but I'm down for her having her moment.
Before we move on, what's the go-to song if you need to just be pumped up for a night out? What are you usually heading towards?
Okay, let me give you genre. Like, I love West African music. So like orchestra, baobab. There's a song, Africa Lonon, like TP Orchestra. Like, I love, there's just this beat, Amadou and Miriam. So those are my go-to because the BPMs are up. My body is moving. You know, you see me moving. I feel it. Yeah, I just feel it. Yeah. So like, that's my go-to.
I love it.
What about you? What do you listen to?
Oh my gosh. So much. Right now, you know, I'm kind of getting back into like a kid of the early 2000s and listening to kind of the emo punk bands. I mean, Paramore, Green Day, Blink 182. So that's what I've been going all-time low. So that's what I've been going back to lately. But, you know, I love this, obviously, as we both been sharing, this diverse amount of music that brings in so many different flavors. You know, I know Etta James, and, you know, I know you've been referenced to Sam Cooke and Etta James and, you know, Bob Marley, like so many important influences and just some of the just coolest music that, you know, you discover on Spotify. And I know Spotify has this new like AI DJ that it's kind of interesting because it brings in new things. It's like, here's what you like, but then also check this out. And so that's been really cool to bring in like new music into my repertoire that I'm like, all right, I'm discovering these artists or bands with less than 100 monthly listeners and just exploring kind of really personal, like I've been getting into like more folk music and, you know, folk country that's like really back to the roots of like what made country, kind of even going back to like juke joints. So anything is on the table. But if I'm going, if I need to pump myself up, it's, you know, the emo punk bands of the early 2000s.
I feel that.
All right. Well, I would like to welcome to the show more than just a musician, a Renaissance woman of her time, Cole Williams, described as a powerhouse of political action, motivated to help others through her music. Cole lends her time as an organizer for the Great New Orleans Citizens Relief Team, WWOZ host, and sought-after entertainer, absolutely chewing up any vocal performances or acting scenes she has come across. I was told chewing up is a good thing. So if anyone's like, what does that mean? But Cole, welcome to Water Cooler Talk.
Oh, that's a warm welcome. Yes, I'm chewing up.
So as this show comes closer to our 100th episode, the significance of language and how we shape conversations has become more and more clear as, you know, we kind of go through each episode. And much of that time through, you know, the course of human history, words and their meanings change as they're continually repurposed within the zeitgeist of whatever current time period we are in. And one of those words is homelessness and this important switch to houselessness. the idea that these individuals are without a house, a physical dwelling, versus, you know, lacking a sense of belonging or sanctuary, a quote unquote home. Because, and not to get into like the live, laugh, love thing, but the home is where the heart is. And that's so important to what this conversation is about. And it completely changes the nuance behind the conversation and the importance of understanding the root cause as we continue to see, you know, higher and higher home prices, you know, rent skyrocketing, but at the same time, you know, vacant homes and apartments going unused. I mean, thousands upon thousands of unused apartments in New York City because the rent is just too high. As we've had this lexicon switch between homelessness to houselessness, how have you seen society's perception of a houselessness individual change?
We're talking about it. We're talking about the unhoused and houseless people. So that's one small step. You know, I'm trying to put myself in the space of my houseless partners and think, they're like, yeah, but we need the damn house.
Exactly.
Resources. But, you know, from where I am, because that's just who I am, I think that that's a small step. But the ultimate goal really is to say displaced, because that's what a houseless person said directly to us. Said, stop calling us homeless and start calling us displaced, because that's what they really are. You know, I thought about this morning. So in my life recently, I've had three people that are very close to me pass away. I never experienced it before. Three elders. The first was my grandmother in 2019. One of my aunts told me that she was bringing her home from the hospital like the last time. We didn't know it was going to be the last, but some suspected, because on her way home, she was saying, I want to go home. I want to go home. And everybody kind of viscerally knew she wasn't talking about that house that she lived at with me and my mother where I grew up. Then in 2022, my mentor, Curtis Muhammad, who trained me in the Ella Baker style of organizing, which I practice with the houseless in my life, which is bottom-up organizing. He passed away in 2022, and I spoke to his family member, and they said that he was saying he wants to go home. And I remember speaking to him the last time, and he said, I'm trying to go home, but they won't take me home. I kind of got nervous, but I didn't go there. And then about a week later, he passed. And then all these stories just about people going home. You know, everybody talks about home when they're close to the end, and they talk about home. It's not this house or anything on this planet. It's something else that none of us know until we get there. You know, so I don't know. I'm just speaking about what I think I know and what I've heard, and I'm just trying to put it out there to help us all process, because that's what the organizing is about, not having the answers, but having the strength and the courage to put our ideas in the pot so that we get to the answers. Being displaced is not fun. There's no humane reason why anybody should be living on the street. I don't care if you're on drugs. I don't care if you're an alcoholic. I don't care if you're a runaway, a prostitute. Like, I don't care what you've done. If you have mental health issues, that's not a judgment that anybody, any of us have the right to make. They don't have to be living in the Playboy mansion, but they do not have to be living under a bridge. And that's what my work is, to get us to all just really go inside of ourselves. Think about the least of us in our families, all those black sheep in our families that we throw aside. Those are all the people living on the street. Those are all the people struggling. Everybody has a black sheep. Think about all those people that we disregard, disrespect, put on the bottom in our workplaces. I always talk about microcosms because that's the way that I learned how to understand what's happening with the houses and what I can do, what I feel inspired to do. I'm one of these people, when I get an idea and it seems to work, and it makes sense for everybody, not just myself, I go out there and I do it. I don't ask permission. I just do it. It's been great to see how the houseless community, the low-income neighbors, have started to work together. So when you come up there on a Saturday to New Orleans and you see us bagging groceries, because we realize people, while they're waiting for homes, need food. So today we've distributed over 40,000 bags of groceries with the assistance of our partners, Trader Joe's and Culture Aid NOLA. It used to be just the haves volunteering, and now it's everybody. Houseless, low income, high income, all colors, all classes, just every background. And most of the time, you really wouldn't know who's who, because there's something that happens when people all get together for one thing that affects everybody and ultimately comes back to us. I think it's wonderful that we're changing the language, but I think that in the time that we're in right now, it's such a poignant time, I think, in our society, in our culture, This is the time for action. We've been talking a lot. There's a lot of theory. We're good at the theory. Now humanity has to take action. What I'm bringing to the table is music and action. There's been a bunch of people, Nina Simone, Miriam Makeba, Sweet Honey in the Rock, Gil Scott-Heron, Bob Marley, people that use music, that understand that music is that most powerful language. And they use the music to speak to humanity, to plant those seeds. So that's what's happening. We're planting seeds.
I love it. And I appreciate you sharing, you know, such personal moments of your life. But I love that idea of we are in a moment of action. It's easy to talk about what's going on and how we can fix these things. But if we're not on the, you know, boots on the ground, well, I don't even want to say boots on the ground because that seems to come from like a very militarized action, because words do matter right there. But having these conversations with people, connecting with these individuals and understanding their needs and their wants and how they look at the situation, and not just, you know, kind of looking from our ivory towers and saying, well, this is your fault. I'm doing fine. Why are you not doing fine? I've worked the system to work for me. But then having these conversations, connecting, whether it be through music, whether it be through food. I mean, as somebody who loves food and that whole aspect of food, I mean, such a great way. I mean, I know you use the gumbo reference. Oh, love a good gumbo. Yeah. But those are ways that we can connect with people and kind of take away the layers of this is not a displaced individual. This is not a houseless individual. This is an individual who, like me, has this extensive life, has these thoughts, has these loves, has these hates, has these connections, and finding what that connection is to see them as another person. I think that's something we're really struggling with today, especially in the US, is the inability to find connection because we want to stay behind the phones. We want to do the virtual signaling. We want to say, I'm here to help. I'm here to put up a, you know, a hashtag on my Instagram, which I do want to be clear. That stuff does help. It helps with awareness. But at the end of the day, you do have to do that next step. You do have to have the action. You do have to understand that the conversation needs to shift to something where we can't just keep letting this happen. We can't just keep letting, you know, thousands upon thousands of apartments go unused and empty and, you know, eventually fall down and rot out because somebody doesn't have $1,500 to rent out a space that should cost half of that. You know, somebody in my position, you know, where I'm at, I think the conversation and the lexicon and the words used do have a big impact on how that conversation starts. And so I think it's so important that we're switching from homelessness to houselessness and we're understanding why we're switching. And through that understanding where the help is needed and how we can do the physical action of changing this situation.
Absolutely. The conversation that happens where what we just had, why is it houseless now? Having that conversation makes it more real. So yeah, you're absolutely right. And what my organization, the Greater New Orleans Citizens Relief Team, started doing is the mission is very clear. We are reclaiming and renovating city-owned, which is citizen-owned, blighted property using citizens' rights while teaching marketable skills. So we're going to work with the houseless people that need a home while teaching them marketable skills with construction volunteers, electrician volunteers, plumbing volunteers. Hopefully there's like a union volunteer that wants to support and, you know, create an apprentice program. There are a lot of people that can work. So this is not about giving anybody anything. This is about using all the resources available, like you said, those lots, and putting them to good use. Why don't we do that? It's like so simple, right? It feels so simple, but then you get to, but we don't do that. That's not what we do. And so, you know, the premise of everything that we've done with the Greater New Orleans Citizens Relief Team is starting from the Declaration of Independence. We, the people, have the right. It's our right. This is our country. It's our land. It's our world. Let's get collective. Let's make collective agreements. Let's come together. Let's stop hoarding. Because the thing is that if everybody has their equal share, I really do believe that some people will still have more, but they won't have as much more as they have now.
Everyone should get a plate before you start going back for seconds.
I love that. Yeah. So some people might get like 3 plates. Some people might get 2 plates, but at least everybody gets 1 plate. And how about if everybody gets 2 plates? it's this wonderful thing that happens when we start regarding everybody and lifting up from the bottom. So I used to be really bad at cooking rice. I'm really good now. But I burnt the rice at the bottom of the pot. So I had to learn how to soak, like in an efficient way. So I soak it. And every time you soak the rice, you lift from the bottom and you get all the rice. So you're not scraping, not leaving anything on the side. And it's a silly, you know, analogy, but it's simple. For me, it's just reminds me that we always do better. We always include everyone when we lift from the bottom. And so that's what regarding the houseless is about. Treat them as people, because you don't let people live under a bridge. Our system isn't perfect, just like Alicia Keys singing isn't always perfect and Cole Williams singing isn't always perfect. So we have to have a lot more compassion. And I think stop being so punitive, be more understanding and compassionate. Let's educate. Let's stop punishing. Let's reform. Let's reframe. Let's undo. Let's unpack. Let's put the stuff that we really want.
You're putting all the words that I have said in almost 100 episodes right back out there. I appreciate it. I think it gets to the bigger aspect of community and connecting to community. And I don't think people realize how close you are to everything crumbling if you don't have that support system. You know, there's been plenty of times in my life, and you probably know, as you know, an artist, and the struggling artist idea is so real. And if you don't have that aspect of family or friends or managers or whatever it may be supporting you, it's very easy to fall behind on bills and payments. And I mean, the amount of, I don't know the exact percentage, but I know it's a high percentage of Americans living paycheck to paycheck. According to payroll.org, 78% of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. And if you lose one of those paychecks, if you get injured, if you, regardless of whatever that may be, if something happens, it's so easy to lose your house, to lose your home, to lose that support system. And that's why I love, you know, what you're kind of doing here with the Greater New Orleans Citizens Relief Team is building that community that we seem to kind of shy away from, to realize that, hey, talk with your neighbors and have those conversations and realize you're more alike than you are different, just because they might like a different sports team or they might like different music than you doesn't mean there's not something that's connecting you deeper than that. And if you fall on hard times, being able to rely on your community, because I think we've gotten to a point, and you know, I think the internet and social media, obviously it's helped so we can have awesome connections and we can connect. The listeners won't know that, but I thought you were just seeming like you were struggling there, almost dying with the cough. I was trying to continue on, like pretend nothing happened, but Alicia Keys, it's Alicia Keys moment. It's not perfect.
It's bigger than a frog. It's a bullfrog in my throat.
Oh my gosh, I love it. I love that that happened. But to kind of finish up my long-winded rant there, it's so important to create community because, you know, sometimes your family's not always going to be there. Some people don't have great families. They don't have those great support systems. They don't have the financial ability to say, go to, like, for example, college and build a support system there with similar like-minded individuals. So relying on community, relying on people that live around you, relying on people that are using the same services as you, you're not this unique individual. You are this unique individual, but you're also an individual that's unique in a community of like-minded, unique individuals.
We're like on the same wavelength, because as soon as you said that, you reminded me of something my godmother said. I was like going through a moment one time, and I'm just like, you know, it was a real moment, but you know, we all need a mentor, somebody to pick us up. And so she said, Cole, you're a textbook case. You know, I'm just like, I want to vent, and I want feedback with the vent, right? Because when we're not solution oriented, that's what we want. We just want somebody to reiterate that mood that we're in. And, you know, after like the conversation, and I had time to process like months later, it made me feel good to know I'm a textbook case. There's so many things that we are experience. You know, I'll take like depression. Depression is like one of the most isolating feelings that you can have, to be depressed. And with depression, you feel like you don't have anyone, you know, which is like the lie that you're telling yourself. But you got to get to that space where you even know that it's like a lie that you're telling yourself, because there is at least one person that you can depend on. One. It may not be somebody close, but one person that you can start to build that community with. if we think about ourselves as these textbook cases and we're unique, but we're not that unique, then we start to really try, make an effort to understand how we connect. And I think fundamentally, our world didn't start with like electricity and skyscrapers and luxury condos and mansions. Like we lived off the land. You know, I don't want to take it like way, way back, but it's like you got to retrace the steps. Like, how did we get here? Well, we got here because our community looked different then. And our community was much more reliant on each other instead of this abstract term of community. Community is like a living thing, the living being. It moves, it changes, it evolves. So we get stuck in an idea of community. And so we've like given up our word. We've given up so many words. We've given up the idea, the concept. You know, we give up our freedom by not really understanding and respecting like where we come from and how vital our contributions are in the present. When I think about the work with the houses, I think about like these, this juxtaposition of like the very bottom and the very top. When I'm trying to make sense of it all, I think about all of these spectrums of high and low, you know, in our society. And what I think about is the young and the old, how the young and the old do not connect. And there are all these reasons. The old, you know, they have a long list of reasons why they can't connect to the young people. The young people don't listen and they don't respect us. And then the young people think that the old people don't listen and they don't feel that they're respected. You know, I think about some of the most profound people in my life have been old people that took the time to talk to me and teach me. And instead of judging me, find out why was I doing that thing that they knew I could do better. But they thought the best way was to first like understand why I was doing it. And then give me some long-winded story that I feel like I'm old people now too because I do it. But, you know, we learn there's wisdom in the stories. And so I built up my tolerance for old people. It's a muscle. Even to this day, like one of my personal managers, my uncle, like my actual Uncle Tony, it challenges me. So sometimes, I mean, like, I'll get off the phone, bye, I'll talk to you later. But I know I will talk to him later because there must be a reason why he said what he said to me. So instead of me feeling attacked and disrespected by the old person, I'm like, if I really trust this old person, they must be saying this, but I don't know, I need more time to see it. And then the old people just have to understand that they got to share. You can't be judging the young people and like, oh, why are you doing that? And you're young. And if I were you, and it's like, but you're not. And you're blessed if you're privileged to be around a young person that's like showing you something that like you could do better. Why not impart that wisdom on that young person? You're probably giving that young person for a reason. On a much smaller scale, our youngest volunteer is 9 years old, Jacqueline. And she has become my best volunteer. And she loves Miss Cole. And she's calling me, Miss Cole, you coming today? Oh, where are you? And I tell her it's 8:30 and it's like 8 o'clock. And she's like, are you on your way? And it's so cute. I see that she admires me. So I don't take it for granted when she says she's going to do something with us, right? Because she says she's going to do something and usually she does it. But then sometimes she becomes like 9 year old her and she doesn't want to keep her commitment. So I take that opportunity to say, if you want to be like Miss Cole, because she's looking at my nails, I always have my nails done, and she's looking at the superficial stuff, which we all love. But what she really doesn't understand is it's like really coming from within. So I say, well, if you really want to be like Miss Cole always does what she says she's going to do. So if you want to be fabulous, the nails are cute, but you got to be consistent, okay? Okay. Who knows if she processes it then, but if I know, like I think I know, because I remember things from when I'm a child, you know, I shared something like I respected her enough to say, don't follow this thing about me without following that thing.
Yeah, without having the context of the situation and understanding. And I think that's when life lessons from elders really hits, is when you have that full context to be like, oh, yeah, I get it. Something switched in my brain. And now I understand these words in a different context. But then also at the same time, elders need to have that understanding of young people. Sometimes they do stupid shit. They got to learn to have that context. And you've been in that same place. I mean, everybody has done something that they're like, oh man, I wish I wouldn't have done that. Or I wish I would have gone through, you know, a different way, a different journey. But we're all here and we've all made the decisions we've made and we have to respect those decisions. And if you're not in the place you want to be in, you got to put in the work to get to where you feel that you deserve to be. And it all stems down to, I mean, we talk about so much on the show, but the aspect of empathy. Older people have to have that empathy for younger people, understanding that they're learning through life. And, you know, younger people have to have that empathy for older people and understand they might have some wisdom to, you know, share with you. It might not all be wisdom you need to take in and internalize, but they've lived that life. They have that understanding.
And it might be a long story. So like, just make the space, mm-hmm. like for that old person, like set aside 45 minutes to an hour. It's going to be a story. And then like, don't see him again for like another month.
I love it. I love it. All right, Cole, are you ready to jump into our final news story of the episode today?
I am.
This one comes from us from WLRN South Florida Health, written by Veronica Zargovia, March 14th, 2024. Music rejuvenates the culture, history, and memories of dementia patients. Candy Cohn used to always speak to her mother, Lillian, in English, with a few words here and there in Yiddish. Then one day, Lillian started singing a beautiful Yiddish love song called Shen Vi De Levon. The song was able to tap into a memory bank her mother, Lillian, still had. In an interview talking about her mother, who passed in 2022, Candy stated, quote, "I never heard her sing it, never heard her play it. The look on her face and the joy, I hadn't seen that in a long time. It brought back so many memories for her. She started telling me how she first heard it and what she was doing," end quote. Experts have explored how music can activate our memories for years. Neurologists explain that episodes of our lives get filed away in an inner region of the brain called the hippocampus. Over time, these memories are stored in the long term in another layer known as the cerebral cortex. Dr. Andrew Budson, who studies the science of memory at Boston University, states, quote, "Even in a person with Alzheimer's whose hippocampus has been destroyed, those older memories are still able to survive in the cerebral cortex," end quote. Tino Negri, owner of Calm for Care, which provides respite for caregivers, has dedicated his free time to volunteer work, bringing interactive music programs to residents with memory disorders. Tino states, quote, "Music is the one thing that opens up people's brains, and it helps fire off neurons on both hemispheres of the brains. Serotonin, which helps our mood, dopamine, a neurotransmitter inclined in learning and emotion, and endorphins, which reduce stress and pain. These are chemicals that make people happy," end quote. Long-term memories, for example, a song tailored to a loved one, can still be accessible long into a disease like Alzheimer's and can become sources of comfort for those dealing with symptoms. Dr. Mark Agroni, Chief Medical Officer for the Mind Institute of Miami Jewish Health, says when music moves a person, when it touches deep, it can allow someone to be rejuvenated and joyful. Having witnessed the rejuvenating impact with her mother, Candy was inspired to sponsor a Yiddish concert earlier in the year and plans to support similar music events in the future for those with dementia. In times of uncertainty, these moments remind us that music can serve as a comforting presence, guiding us back to cherished memories and shared experiences. So listener, obviously, you know, broke down the article. It's a very good article to read. So if you have the time, read the full article. But just want to have a little breakdown for you. So Cole, your journey has been characterized by your ability to evoke powerful emotions and connection through your music. Reflecting on this story, how do you perceive the ability of music to tap into memories and emotions and kind of its role in providing comfort and this pathway to purpose?
Everything that we've talked about regarding music is like leading us to this space. Music is the healer. Music is life. You know, the doctors are talking about the serotonin and, you know, I don't know all that stuff. But looking at the brain, how the brain processes it, music, and I think that's a real thing, but it's so interesting. These sound waves, how are they programmed into the brain to reignite memory? I find that fascinating. We've spoke about what music, what's on our playlist to go out. When I think about different songs, for example, like when I hear The Doors or Pink Floyd, I'm in the time. There's like a year cycle. Like I can tell you like what was happening in my life, you know, because like I got into them at a certain point in my life. Or if I'm listening to like reggae, it brings me really back to my childhood because I'm first generation Jamaican American. So I grew up around a lot of first generation Caribbean children. It's like my childhood. When I hear like contemporary Christian music, I'm thinking about like church. Very religious family. I was raised Seventh-day Adventist. So like music was super significant because on our Sabbath, that was Friday night to Saturday night, I couldn't play secular music. So music definitely defined my household. I knew, even if I didn't know what day it was, I knew what day it was by the sound, by what sounds were playing. How wonderful that we're aware that we know the power of music. You know, just how it can make those last years kind of more soothing. You know, an ex-boyfriend of mine, his father, similar story, he heard his father sing for the first time in a nursing home. He had dementia. So he thought, when did my father hear the song? I didn't know my father could sing. I don't even have the words. Musicians are the messengers, you know, we're angels here put to plant messages. And so that's why I really think it's important that we do have a balance of messages, because the message is so powerful and healing.
And this is kind of the accumulation of really the conversation we're having today about the power of music, because only music can tap into something deeper, that it makes you dance, it makes you cry, it makes you, you know, laugh, it makes you happy, it makes you sad. It hits all these emotions. There's some sort of song for that. Like, you don't go to the movies. I mean, there's some like a musical, but even to the musical, it's music where you're getting up, you're dancing, you're having a good time. And the aspect of, even if you don't got any rhythm, like as a white guy, my dancing skills, I mean, I think I'm good, but if you videoed me, probably would say otherwise. But music makes me feel comfortable and makes something in my body move to where, even though I may not be the greatest dancer ever, you know, I do the classic, the white guy move, the white guy shuffle.
That's good.
It does. It makes you move, and no other art form that at least I've experienced in my life makes you move, makes you touch something different.
Because you're tapping in. You're talking about, like, it makes you, you feel, you think you can't dance, but you don't even care. Like, that's not even a thought because of the music. It just overrided, like, all of your self-doubt. So music is not about perception. You know, what you're perceiving, it's about how you're feeling. And that in of itself is subjective. It's something about this work that I do. And so these songs that I'm writing that I'm inspired by, like the songs like We Shall Overcome and Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud, and The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, and What's Going On, and, you know, all these songs, and even some less direct messages, but they were all just like alive. And so I'm writing these songs like Sign of the Times and Give Power to the People. And yeah, it just makes me think of how important it is that we just have an equitable disbursement of musical messages, because they're so vital to all the people, everybody that's going through different experiences. We need something to connect to.
Well, and I think just art in general gives those who may not have the privilege or the platform to share their voice, to share their mind, to share their thoughts, to share their heart. And because of that, going back to this whole conversation in that first story with Alicia Keys, like, it allows people to be vulnerable. It allows people to be authentic. And that's what people connect on. And I think, I hope, Cole, that we're seeing the shift in the social media landscape of, it does not need to be tailored. It does not need to be changed to hit these metrics. Like, oh my gosh, I need to post on a Tuesday at 3:15. I need to say this specific thing to connect to an audience. And I'm hoping that we're seeing this shift as, obviously, AI comes into the space and we're seeing how disconnected that is, that the shift goes to this idea that real authentic music, real authentic art, real authentic conversations are what come out of this conversation, because we can see that they have authenticity. Vulnerability has this deep connection that can pull people out of Alzheimer's and dementia, can bring back these memories when we do have these moments that connect to something deeper, you know, whether it be listening to Dark Side of the Moon, driving home late at night, and, you know, those instrumentals just hitting a little different, and having that idea of, I mean, I spent a lot of time living on the road and living in my car. And every time I think of that open road, Hey There Delilah is the song that just immediately transports me back, because I think, and I'm not going to show you, I'm not going to prove it, but I think I can vocalize with the singer, the Plain White Tee singer. I think we're on the same length. I think I can sing that song live, but I'm never going to do it. But it brings me back to those moments of being on the open road and understanding that complete freedom. And so whenever I hear that song, and maybe, you know, when I'm 90, 95, I don't really want to live past 95. I think that's it for me. But when I'm at those moments and I hear Hey There Delilah when I'm 93, I can think back to those moments where I was like, man, I'm happy. I have freedom. I have this whole idea of the world ahead of me. And art does that way differently when it's real, when it's vulnerable.
Yeah. I hope somebody takes away your car keys, though, when you hear that song at 95. Grab the keys.
By that time, we'll have automatic cars. I won't even have to worry about it.
Oh, my goodness. I don't even want you giving directions to the automatic car. Grab the microphone. No, it's so true. We've always communicated through music. Drums, call and response. Let's go back to different tribes in Africa. That was how they spoke, the talking drum. Call and response is still big in all African music, where it's a feeling, the singer, the musicians, like everybody is listening. And there are these conversations that are truly happening in music. I'm a great listener. And as a great listener, and I'm not just saying that because like to toot my own horn, but I'm a great listener because I mean, strangers talk to me and I don't mind listening because sometimes I know people, they just want to be heard. And then I have my people that like, I can really just like, blah. Everybody wants to feel heard. And I don't think enough of us feel heard because most of us are just trying to talk. Think about like how many conversations you have throughout the day where like people are just waiting for you to stop speaking so that they can say what they wanted to say, but they're not responding. So I think with music, the music that people connect to, it's maybe, I'm just making this up right now, but maybe it's like conversations that feel compatible to conversations that we have or feel familiar or the conversations that we'd like to have. I think it's very visceral. So I think as much as we can define music, I think that there's this indescribable part of music that we can't define. And that's the magic. We just do. I can't tell you why I understand the mathematical breakdown of music. If I really need to break it down for my musicians, I will, but it's more of a doing thing. I feel it. It's much easier to do it, but I can break it down like the 4/4 signature and what notes need to go here. But to really like sit and explain it, it's like I got to switch my brain. So there's this language. It's language. When I teach my students, I have a section of call and response when I'm training them, because as much as you want to have your own style, right, and develop that, you also have to develop your ear to listen. Listen to your musicians. They might give you something that you didn't ask for, but it might be great. They might be going in another direction, and they might not have time to come back, and you might have to just go on that road with them in that moment on the show. Call and response is about being able to repeat what you've heard in real time and all those notes. And so that, for me, I've noticed as a teacher, that's one of the most difficult spaces for new singers, is to sing back what they've heard.
And that's even in the podcast space, you know, working with other hosts, understanding the music of a conversation. It's, you know, doing background, and you, I do have some pre-prepared questions that kind of hit connecting the story to you. But for most of this conversation, it's just been responding back and forth between what we're saying, because that's where the conversation is flowing. And that's why, you know, some of those interview shows, I'm like, there's a good opportunity to have a good conversation here, but you're so focused on getting to that next question that you miss the nuance and the layers of having a good conversation and exploring something deeper. And I know, obviously, sometimes producers are always in the ear. It's like, hey, we got to get to this next thing. We need to cover this. This is what we really want to talk about. But sometimes you just got to sit in the moment and understand where you're at and the connection between humans, and not just, hey, you're a person I can have on my show, and now I'm on to the next guest. Like, each of these, you know, 96 episodes I've had have been very personal moments for me, connecting with absolutely amazing people. And I always leave each of these conversations being like, man, my day is instantly better because I met this person today. You know, I had this conversation, whether it be remote or in person. And it leads to this aspect of, once again, you know, the realness, the vulnerability, and the importance of understanding the conversational flow of humanity and what works and what doesn't. Like, I've been trying to get people onto jazz, man. It's not just elevator music. Like, real jazz is a conversation between all the different parts of that band or those musicians, and it builds to something great. But you have to take the time to slow down and listen and really understand the conversation that's being had.
You just said something so profound. That is the fundamental mission. That is what bottom-up organizing is. Patience. It took patience, you know, to organize and listening. Can I share a story with you?
Of course.
This is the story that Curtis Muhammad shared with me when he was trying to explain to me the type of organizing that Ella Baker taught him, which he was teaching me. So in the 60s, you know, there was segregation, and in the North, a lot of the students were integrating lunch counters. So that was their political, their social move. Let's go to the lunch counters that are segregated and let's integrate them so that Black and white can sit there together. That's our move. So went to jail, successful in some spaces, decided to come down South because that's where like the stuff was really going wrong, right? Jim Crow came to Mississippi. They were told to meet Miss Ella Baker. So these are students from SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. So they come from the North to the South, meet Miss Ella Baker. They say, hey, Miss Baker, we were told to come and meet you. You know, we want to work down here. So Miss Ella Baker, she'd also been working with Dr. Martin Luther King. So she said, oh, okay, well, so I heard that y'all been integrating lunch counters. That's nice and all, but you should probably go and see what the people want. So she sent them to like go live with people, meet different people, like real people in the community that they wanted to organize to integrate lunch counters. But she said, before you tell them to integrate lunch counters, why don't you go to them and ask them what they want to do? Like, how do they want to go to the next step of being free? They did what she said. Hey, you know, Miss Baker sent us and she asked us to, you know, talk to you. So we've been integrating lunch counters in the North and desegregation is big. We think we have the right to be free. So we want to come here and do the same thing. But what do you want to do? Do you want to do that? And the people responded, yeah, that's cool. But what we really want is the right to vote. So the right to vote in this country started because those student organizers were told by Miss Ella Baker to go to the people, the most in need, ask the people what they want, and work with the people to create a strategy and a plan to get the people what they need to move forward. So what you said, listening, the responding, like all of these things, these are fundamental basics in how we treat each other. So where have we turned away from that? Like, how did we get so distracted from that? I mean, I see that we all need help. This is not just a you, I, like, I need help. I'm aware to a certain extent, so I'm doing my best. But how do we as a society get so turned upside down where we talk more and we judge more and we point more instead of like receiving and sharing and just all those things that help us grow, like the natural order of the universe, like trees grow, plants grow. There's a season. I mean, these things happen with or without us. Rain is falling, sun is shining. So we're part of that. But we've as humans, we've disconnected ourselves from that piece. And we can have our technology and we can have our luxuries, whatever we consider them to be. But we got to include all of humanity in this entire society that we're depending on.
That perfectly set me up to make it seem like I am the greatest host ever because, you know, in the Greater New Orleans Relief Team, you have on your website designing a world where we all live in humanity. And that when I read that, I was like, yeah, that's it right there. We need to focus on this idea of continuing to improve our world and understanding that everything that's being done doesn't just affect me or my friends or my family. It affects everybody. It impacts everybody in the world. Obviously, you know, as someone who's worked in the human wildlife conflict space, you know, stuff that happens in regards to the expansion of humans. And, you know, COVID was a good example of that. We expanded into these natural areas and nature was like, I'm getting you back. Or, you know, when it comes to climate change, you know, and even these big world things. But even going down to the more microcosms of our community and the issues within those communities, these all small things just build up to something bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, but they all impact us in different ways. And we need to understand that we're in this together. And I think Ronald Reagan might have said it. He said to the point of like humanity comes together when we have like a common enemy. And it seems like we have so many potential enemies. I don't even think it was Ronald Reagan who said this, and I don't want to give him the credit for saying something cool, because Reaganomics completely has fucked the country. But the basic idea, and I'll find out who said it, but the basic idea is like we need like aliens to come down for us to unite.
Turns out my memory is not that bad. This was actually Ronald Reagan who said this during an address to the United Nations General Assembly in 1987. President Reagan stated,
"In our obsession with antagonisms of the moment, we often forget how much unites all the members of humanity. Perhaps we need some outside universal threat to make us recognize this common bond. I occasionally think how quickly our differences worldwide would vanish if we were facing an alien threat from outside this world. And yet, I ask you, is not an alien force already among us? What could be more alien to the universal aspirations of our peoples than war and the threat of war?
But really, we're having these issues that we should be uniting over just because it will create a better society, it'll create a better humanity, it'll create better peer-to-peer connection, and we shouldn't need aliens coming to attack Earth to bond together.
We just on the roll. So to piggyback, yeah, why do we need an enemy? I think about this. Think about all these many enemies we've created. We're going against ourselves. And I think about, you know, the term of revenge. Revenge is such an interesting thing because you think you're getting revenge on someone, but you're not getting revenge on them. Because most of the time that person like has no idea the depths of like how you feel. So that's number one. But the thing actually ends up coming back to you. Like nothing really happens to that other person. So the things that we think we're doing to other people, we're doing it to ourselves. We think that we're like disregarding this person. Like, I don't care about homeless people. Well, hey, now we have more of them because we had a pandemic. And so the housing insecure became houseless. Like, let's say it's not affecting me now and it might not affect me in my lifetime. But I'm so appreciative and grateful to be living on this planet, soaking up the resources, most of them for free, except for the water. I don't know why they're charging for water, but that's another, invite me back. But, you know, for me, it's like, I'm soaking up these resources. I'm living in New Orleans, good, the humidity, the weather's great. My skin feels great. Teeth look good. I'm telling you, like, these are things I do during the day, like at the beginning of the day to set myself up to say, I'm going to go out here and be the best I can be. And I'm going to forgive myself when I'm not.
Cole, I want to thank you for taking the time to share your perspective on some of the strangest and most bizarre news stories the world has to offer in an engaging, productive, and meaningful conversation. Listeners, if you would like to continue to hear more from Cole and her current work, take a moment to check out her music and her band and what they've released. You can do so by following her through her socials at Cole Williams Official on Instagram and TikTok. Once again, Cole Williams Official. And of course, those links, including other links that you have for your socials, will be included in the episode description and on our website, www.watercoolertalkpod.com. So as I mentioned, Cole, I feel like you've been ending these conversations so well, but you got to do it one more time. I'm asking, you're live on stage, you're in front of thousands of people, one more time, the encore's coming. Cole, we have now gone to my favorite part of the show, the segment where I hand off the show, one listener called a hoot and a half, over to you to close it however you see fit. The Huffington Post has called you the heart of Bob Marley, the soul of Sam Cooke, and the grit of Etta James. So if you are open to the challenge of channeling those great musicians to bring forth their wisdom to our listeners, Cole, the mic is hot, line shape right, and the floor is yours. And the stage is yours in this case.
All right, line me up. Wade in the water, wade in the water, children, wade in the water. Freedom troubles the water. See that man all dressed in red. Freedom troubles the water. He looks like the man that Moses led. Freedom troubles the water. Come on and wade in that water. Wade in that water, children, wade in that water, 'cause freedom troubles the water. Oh, freedom troubles the water. Yeah, freedom troubles the water. And freedom troubles the water.
I love it. Congratulations. I love it when I have musicians on and they just knock it out. Like, obviously this will go out to thousands of people, but in this moment, we just had a personal concert and I freaking love it.
You put me on the spot.
Well, Cole, no, I very, very much appreciate this conversation. And I think there's going to be space for many more conversations together in the future if you're open to it, because I think we have so much more to talk about. But in this moment, I'm so thankful for you being able to come on the show and share your experiences and your perspectives and have a really wonderful conversation. And at least to me, I think conversations are art. So we created a piece of art here today.
Thank you so much. I think what you're doing is so wonderful. Thank you for having me on. I'm grateful for you for sharing your platform with me. And I'm looking forward to many more conversations. This was so fun and uplifting.
I love to hear that. It gets my ego way higher than it needs to be. But listeners, we are going to take a short break. And when we come back, the show will be over. Peace.
This is the story of a podcast that takes weird news from across the world. And while many of these stories may seem fake, they're absolutely not, because they're real.